If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
If you're like me and you prefer to just be ultra cautious and like just aren't comfortable deploying at this point, then you've got to take a look at what the government policies are going to be, how they're rolling out, what's going to get approved, and probably equally as importantly, the tax increases and some of the stuff that's been proposed that is not as favorable for real estate going forward. You got to watch that real carefully.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Wanted to give you the heads up that today's episode is a double episode. So this is twice as long as our normal episodes are, but that's really on purpose because the content that was being produced in this episode was so good, we just couldn't stop. And it felt unfair to you to stop recording and say, okay, that's it. That's a wrap. So I certainly hope you enjoy what we've put out today. And look forward to hearing any feedback. Thanks so much. Jeremy Roll started investing in real estate and businesses in 2002 and left the corporate world in 2007 to become a full-time passive cash flow investor. He is currently an investor in more than 60 opportunities across more than $1 billion worth of real estate and business assets. As founder and president of Roll Investment Group, Jeremy manages a group of over 1,500 investors who seek passive, managed cash flowing investments in real estate and businesses. Jeremy is also the co-founder of Four Investors by Investors, a nonprofit organization that was launched in 2007 with the goal of facilitating networking and learning among real estate investors in a strict, no-sales pitch environment. Phoebe is now the largest group of public real estate investor meetings in California with over 30,000 members. Jeremy has an MBA from the Wharton School, is a licensed California real estate broker for investing purposes only, and is an advisor for Realty Mogul, the largest real estate crowdfunding website in the U.S., Jeremy welcomes emails, jroll@rollinvestments.com, to network with or help other investors and to discuss real estate or business investments of any size. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me today. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. I certainly appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule here to jump on with us. I think most people have a good idea of who you are. Obviously, you're very active in the real estate space. You're very, you know, you've been on a lot of podcasts and a lot of shows, and obviously you've presented a lot. I've been to several conferences where you've been a presenter, and it's always good. So in order to save time and really get to more of the deeper thoughts that you have economically, I'd love to hear kind of just succinctly who you are as an investor right now, what you've kind of done, and then, you know, we can kind of maybe focus more on economics and things like that. So I don't know if you can just give us kind of a brief overview of who you are.
Sure, I'll give you the brief take for sure. And thanks again. I hope this is helpful for your listeners. And I just want to give everybody the apology. I have COVID here. We're recording this early 2021. I live in LA. There's lockdowns. I'm trying to get my barber over to my house. That's not so easy. So, you know, I don't normally look like this. So that's out of the way. Have to say it. So anyway, so I am a full-time passive cash flow investor. I focus mostly on relatively low-risk opportunities, and I focus on cash flow. I've been investing in these types of opportunities, mostly in real estate, but also some cash flowing business type of assets since 2002. So it's been about 19 years, but I've been full-time since 07. So the cash flow actually got me out of the corporate world back in 07, and I've been full-time since. And my number one goal is to continue my cash flow stream and build it further so I never have to go back to the corporate world.
That's awesome. So in 07, you started, or in 02, you started building your passive income. In 07, you left entirely.
That's right.
And so one of the things I think that you are known for, and again, we'll kind of jump, you know, we'll go right into the heart of things here. I think one of the things that you're commonly known for is having sat on the sidelines for the last, what, 3-4 years now?
Yeah, so I did the same thing between 05 and 08. I sat on the sidelines and a lot of people thought I was nuts. It's a very long haul when you do that. It's very aggravating. And same thing's happening to me this time. And I feel like we're going to get into some of this, but I feel like now what's going on right now is making me on the sidelines even further. And so I was hoping I wouldn't have to stay on the sidelines as you know, even further, but it seems like the recent elections and everything else and the stimulus, a lot of it I think is resulting in that. So I've been on the sidelines pretty much since the end of 2016. When I say that, I've still invested in many things. It's just been a much lower volume than normal for me. And I've only looked at unique opportunities. And I continue to only really look at unique opportunities or stuff that I think will make sense in a certain environment. So Yeah, so I'm still on the sidelines, and I intend to be on the sidelines for the most part in 2021 with the exception of unique opportunities, which definitely come up. I mean, I've actually made several investments here in the last probably 4 to 8 weeks, but so it's not like I do nothing. It's just that I normally do a ton of volume because I'm hyper diversified, but I've been philosophically in the sidelines for an average market rate deal.
Right. So what is a unique opportunity? I mean, that sounds like a buy box that's almost impossible to find something to invest in.
Yeah, let me give you one that I think a lot of listeners will kind of relate to, because you know, a lot of people are investing in multifamily. And so I have invested in numerous multifamily deals in the last 10 years, but probably very few since the end of 2016 or maybe even 15. And they've all been unique. I've probably done maybe, if I had to guess, probably 5 to 10. And since then, I just invested in December in a low-income tax housing tax credit facility, which essentially is somewhat rent controlled by the government. Okay. But if you're worried about asset prices going down or rents going down, it actually has a mitigation of that, meaning the rents aren't going to come down as much as market typically. And not only that, but I'm concerned about whether asset prices may adjust downwards in the next couple of years because of where we are today. And that particular building has 17 years of a tax credit stipulation remaining. And once the tax credit restrictions are lifted, somebody could take it to market. So if you think about it, even though I personally am on the sidelines right now versus not, I'm the type of person who doesn't want to worry about an asset price going down and then going back up over a 10-year period. I just rather wait on the sidelines. Like that's not, there's a million ways to invest. It's just one way to do it. There's nothing wrong with the other way for sure. Just not my comfort level. So the great thing about that type of situation is that if we buy that building now, even if it goes down a little, we already have built-in padding automatically in 10 years when we sell it, because tax credits come off in 7 years after that. And the next buyer is going to pay premium to get the building in the period in which they'll be able to raise the rents before they have to sell it. So that kind of adds in automatic padding, and it adds in it reduces the risk of rents coming down as much as the next building. So, and also the lower end, that type of building in the right location will just have sustained demand for so many reasons, you know, because of the fact that it's, you know, I think that particular one was 25 to 30% below market rents as it stood today, just so you know. So there's a combination of stuff that made it unique that actually gave me enough risk mitigation in this environment to get comfortable with it, where I cannot get comfortable with most things. And that's just one example.
Right, right. Can you walk us through, and I don't want to stay here too long, but I am curious how a deal like that works. What does that mean when there's low income housing tax credits?
Yeah, so I am not an expert because I'm not the sponsor, but I'll give you my high level understanding. And there's different ways it can work. In some of those types of facilities, a tenant will apply. It's very strict on regulation by the state, where the sponsor has to take a package of like a whole income form, all like tax receipts, you know, proof of how much someone's making. They have to be certain units are a certain percentage of household income. So one unit, someone can have 10 two bedrooms that are 50% of average household income in the area. You can't qualify for it if you make more than 50%, for example. Some of them might be 35%, but if you make 40%, you won't qualify for it, right? So the buildings are all, it's a little complicated. So different units go for different amounts, and every single one has to be approved by the state. It's very heavily regulated. In exchange, there are certain tax credits you get towards those units. Sometimes there's actually, in some states, there's either a lower amount of tax or no tax that you have to pay. So let me give you an example. I'm looking at another deal right now, just coincidentally, like they don't come up hardly ever, but there's another one where the sponsor is looking to buy the building from the state. They own it right now. The state doesn't want to own it anymore. There's 18 months left on the loan restriction. And what's amazing is that they're negotiating with the state on the actual terms. So right now they're negotiating not taxes on the property, but the equivalent of 25% of taxes is a fee, but the fee is subordinated to the loan. And if you ever go below the debt coverage ratio, the fee is actually just deferred with no interest. So it's much harder to default on the property and not be able to cover that, because there's either no taxes, low taxes, and even if you can't pay them, they're not going to get a lien or anything. So, you know, that's just one example. And in that example, we're actually able to refi in 18 months when the loan restriction comes off, and probably cash out a lot of people's money, because the way those buildings are valued are not based off of NOI multiple. It's actually based off market rent multiple, even though your NOI is much lower. So your purchase price is lower. It's very complicated. But the point is, it's very unique, right?
Right.
But I think the more important thing is all these complications breed this uniqueness and these opportunities that could make sense in a challenging environment. They're just really hard to find. And it's very hard to find a sponsor that understands it, can manage it really well, and has the experience behind it.
Yeah, I mean, everything you've just said, I could probably read, you know, it's not like I need about a 500-page book to, you know, really get into the nitty-gritty and actually have a firm understanding of what it is you just said, because a lot of that actually went right over my head. So like you said, though, those are unique opportunities that for the person that does get it, you know, that presents a buy opportunity for you.
Yes. So, you know, I could give you so many other examples of unique stuff I'm investing in right now, but it doesn't come up that often. But when it comes up, you jump on it. But if it's not unique, I probably won't look at it right now. That's the thing.
Right. Sure. So which I guess that brings me to two other questions. You know, one, if you are quote unquote on the sidelines, that would either mean that you're cash heavy.
Yes.
I guess. So if you're cash heavy, do you view cash as a wasting asset?
In general? Yeah, for sure. I don't want to be cash heavy.
Right. So like, how do you sleep at night going, gosh, you know, they're printing the heck out of money. Like, is my money going to be worth, you know, 60% of what it is in 2 years? You know, what do you see on that front? And how do you not justify, but I guess what keeps you motivated to hold cash when we see kind of the wild things that are occurring?
Yeah, they're great questions. So in my networking over many years with probably thousands of investors over time, I found there's two different philosophies for this topic. There's one, which is mine, which is that, and I wouldn't say mine, it's a personality fit. There's mine, which is I'm just really low risk. I'd sleep better at night knowing that I'm not deploying into the wrong thing at the wrong price. So I'll just sit on the cash if I have to and wait for the right thing to come up. And then there's the other person who wants to have all their money working all the time to keep up as much as possible. And they're going to have more volatility, I think, in what they're investing in as a result, because in some ways they're taking more risk by definition, but they're frankly going to be better off at the finish line, in my opinion. They're going to be higher net worth at the end of the day. They're going to have done better at the end of the day, but they're going to have to be comfortable with the concept of being able to deal with the risk at the same time, right? And so I fall into the camp where I'm not fully optimized from a dollar, a number perspective, but I kind of am more comfortable with that from a personality perspective. So that's kind of the way that I deal with it. Now, that being said, don't get me wrong. I am spending all my time trying to figure out and agonize, how do I get some of this money working? What's the safest way right now? I've concluded for myself that a lot of short-term stuff, if I can find it, like 6 to 12 month stuff, or stuff that either repays back very quickly, or stuff where I'm not having to worry about the underlying asset value, like those low income tax credit deal that I explained before. I'm not worried about the value going down because we have the imputed amount built up and it's going to be in 10 years, et cetera. So I'm looking for these weird, unique things to do. I'm finding them here and there to be able to offset some of that. And I'm deploying that money as much as I can. Another one thing I'm doing right now is a little bit of short-term hard money flips. In a very unique way, though, I have a friend of mine who's been doing it for me for years. He's got his money behind mine. I'm at 50% LTV with a 10% interest rate, right? That's not normal.
Right.
But, and I slowed down last year because I was afraid of what was going to come up this year. But now I'm starting again, because with all the stimulus money, I think we're probably good on that for 6 to 12 months. So, you know, now I'm starting to put that money out to make it work again. So it's constantly changing.
Right. Oh, I'm sure it is. I mean, just as you keep track of what they're doing in Washington, I mean, yeah, it's constantly changing. So that's interesting. Yeah, that is interesting that you said, you know, you're doing flip money and hard money loans like that. I would think that that is inherently more risky. I mean, that's one of the first things that default. But like you said, you know, you're at 50% LTV.
Yes. So, and even at that, I wasn't comfortable necessarily being in as much last year because of all the uncertainty and all the foreclosure risk and everything else. But now that we just have now that the Democrats won Georgia, and I don't even vote because I'm disgruntled with, you know, all the politicians and the lobbyists. But so to me, just trying to figure out what it means. But with the Democratic win in Georgia, I feel like there's a much higher probability that this bigger amount of stimulus is going to be pushed through. There's going to be more kicking of the can down the road. And that gives me more comfort in the next 6 to 12 months for like a 6 to 9 month flip horizon, for example.
Right. So even though we have, you know, enormous jobless claims, even though, you know, all this, you know, businesses are closing left and right, you just think that we've done nothing more than to continue to pump up the bubble. So maybe there's a little bit more time between when we see a correction than perhaps what you thought previously.
Exactly. I think that the result of these Georgia elections is that the next 6 to 9 to 12 months, and I'm not sure the exact timeline, has become more predictable, in that there's going to be more stimulus and therefore it's going to green light for that amount of time. What I think becomes less predictable, which is frustrating me, is that after 12 months, 2 to 5 year outlook has become more challenging, and I'm still trying to sort it out because there's headwinds associated with the new president in terms of taxes, in terms of depreciation, in terms of 1031, other things we're uncertain about that could hit real estate investors. So I'm concerned in the beyond the 1 year period. And that's why I'm trying to find stuff that works for today. That also maybe doesn't, non-real estate where I don't have to worry about the underlying asset value. And that also has a very quick payback period.
Right. That's interesting. So one of the things that you'd mentioned earlier was you were afraid of asset values declining. So that's why you like this low income housing tax credit deal. Is that what you see as a potential on the horizon, or could we see hyperinflation? And I know this is, you have no crystal ball, but I'm just curious what you're thinking.
Yeah. So I am of the, like, it's anyone's guess. I'm not better than anyone's guess, right?
Sure. But that's all I'm asking for.
Yeah. Yeah. The model that I'm following that I think we're going to go down the path that we're going, and I think the path we've been going down for a decade already, is if you take a look at what happens with Japan, which started in the 90s, they have been kind of just scrambling to keep afloat. And a lot of people can argue that it's for somewhat for the same reasons and a lot for the different reasons. They've got a more demographic headwinds. They've got some other issues that they had. They increased interest rates tremendously and it started that recession and everything tanked as a result. We haven't done that, but talk about it in the early 90s. But fundamentally what's happened is that they've gone to huge amounts of debt. And what that's done is become a huge overhang on their economy. And we've started on the same path. And even though today, sitting here with a $2 trillion stimulus is going to be proposed this week from what I've read, you could have gone back 10 years. I was having discussions with people over 10 years ago saying we're already going down this Japan path. Back then, even without all this incremental debt we've had in the last 12 months. And what's happened is that if you take a look at structurally the potential of our economy, in 2000 to 2010, the potential GDP was probably about 4%. The economy could probably hit 4% if it was really chugging along. In 2010 to 2020, the real potential was 3% because we started to add on debt after the last downturn, and it was a drag. There's other reasons, productivity and all this stuff, but the bottom line is that debt's starting to cause the drag, right? And so no matter how much stimulus Trump tried to put in the economy, even when we weren't even in a downturn, just getting past that 3 was really not realistic, even though he talked about getting to 4 and stuff. It just wasn't built into the numbers and the way things work and the amount of drag that it is.
Right.
But what I think is going to happen is with all this money being printed right now is that we're going to look at probably between 0.5 and 2% average GDP growth, or maybe 1 to 2 over the next decade into this new cycle. And that's just a guess. But no doubt there's going to be more drag and there's going to be less potential in the GDP. Now, by the way, I'm going to put aside, we're probably going to have an inordinate increase here in the next year when things open up because we're coming from such a low, like if you start here and you go down here, even if you just get back up to here, the percentage increase down here is quite significant. So I think there's going to be an anomaly as we get up the first couple of quarters of like whatever, you know, just like there's already been an anomaly so far. And after that, though, when things normalize, I think that we're going to be at a very low level. And I think that that's going to be the result of the debt. They're going to keep printing more money. What I'm worried about, frankly, is that this could be our last normal cycle. And what I mean by that is that if you look what happens in Japan these days, there's somewhere between 0.5, 1, negative 0.5, negative 1 growth. Every quarter is different. So as an investor, the problem that that causes is that when you and I buy an apartment building right now, we think to ourselves, okay, in a 10-year outlook, it's probably going to be worth more. In a 10-year outlook, we can push rents every year on average at a certain inflation rate, et cetera. What happens when you don't know if a certain quarter in a certain year in 5 or 6 or 7 years is going to be negative or positive every time? Totally different problem, right? So to me, this is potentially the last cycle we have. I know this is a big claim and I don't know if it's going to be true, but I can see this being the last cycle we have where we have this 0.5 to 2% GDP growth. And assuming they handle things the same way in the future as they had to now, which is print more money, print our way out of it, then we're eventually going to have a drag to the point where we're going to be Japan and we're going to be bobbing along at like negative 0.5 plus 0.5, depending on the quarter. The Japanese, the government owns over 40% of the stocks at this point because they've gone through so much QE, it's gotten to that point. Mm-hmm. And after the next cycle is when I get really worried because we can't necessarily count on being able to push rents in a negative 0.1, negative 1 GDP environment. Or what happens in 3 years if it's a negative 1 GDP? Because that's going to be up, down, or we're just constantly teetering along the brink, right? So I'm thankful that I think we have one more cycle. I don't know what's going to happen after that. And so with all this to say is that my opinion is that the interest rates in general are going to be artificially kept low by the government. I don't think we can afford for them to go up. And I think that what happens with all this money printing is that a lot of it does go to assets. And I think what you're going to see is that interest rates probably stay low. And like what's happened in Japan, although they struggle with it sometimes, is that you may have to focus more on making your money off asset price increase as opposed to cash flow. because ultimately, if the interest rates come down more, the spread and, you know, people are going to pay lower and lower cap rates because the spread's going to be there. The cash flow is going to be lower. And all of a sudden, you're going to be looking at a 4 or 5 or 6% cash flow as an investor and saying to yourself, is that really going to keep me ahead of real inflation on my money? And that's a problem, right? Because when you're making 8 or 9%, you're probably in okay shape. When you're making 4% or 5%, that's a different discussion, right? Because what's true inflation? That's a whole other topic, right?
That's going to be my next point, yeah.
Right. So I think that as investors, we're going to have to start relying on more speculation of asset prices as opposed to cash flow to keep ahead. Down the road, I think this cycle will probably still be okay, but this might be the last one.
Right, right. And as an investor, that does not build confidence.
No, although what's interesting to note is that you have the confidence of knowing that probably, from a probability, we're probably going to have one more good cycle. You probably want to get into a situation where you're either going to want to sell into the end of the cycle for the lack of predictability, or at least have an asset where you're going to be okay, not counting on high cash flow levels after that necessarily, even from that asset necessarily. We don't know. You know, and I could be completely wrong, but I'm starting to I'm going to watch how things unfold in the next 5 years and obviously, you know, tweak the opinion. But if this is what happens, I feel like, because I'm a cash flow investor, that's what's killing me, right? So this might be my last cycle to really look at cash flow as the number one focus for myself. And it's important to know that.
Right. No, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. So yeah, how do you prepare other than to acquire assets now when they are potentially less expensive?
Look, I mean, anyone can argue that if you buy and hold an asset for speculation at this point, because it's more likely there'll be more and more money printing and that the government's going to start taking more and more things over, just like they have in Japan, that asset value is going to go up over time. And that's how you shield yourself from some of this potential inflation you're talking about, especially on the asset pricing. Problem again with that is that it's speculation, right? That means you may not be investing for cash flow as much and that you're kind of rolling the dice more, right? So one can argue that if you buy an asset today and hold it for 20, 30 years, it's going to be in a much, much better place. And that's going to help against it. You know, that may be one way to look at it. I don't normally get involved in a 20 or 30 year hold. I normally get involved in a 10 year hold. So it's a bit different.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. So what market events would have to occur for you to say now is the time to get back in?
Right. So there's actually several things that have to happen for me to regain comfort level going into a normal market rate deal, I call it, right? So one is, stimulus has to come to an end or very close to it so that we're not artificial anymore with stimulus. Two is that rent abatement has to stop so we see what's really going on with rents and what people can really afford. Three is that rent subsidies have to stop from local and state governments so that we can actually see what people can really afford. I'm just using multifamily as an example. I invest across all asset classes, but that's just what they want to understand. So yeah, so the rent subsidies have to stop on behalf of local and state governments so we really see what renters can afford. In any event, those are three. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the four. But there's four things that I have written down that I'm waiting on actually checking the boxes off of. And until we see what happens with all those, the eviction moratoriums. Sorry, the eviction moratoriums. So once we see all that happen, and then I should probably add to the list the fact that foreclosure, you know, those, the required postponement of foreclosure, depending on the type of loans and everything, especially on the single family side. Once all that artificial stuff gets out of the way and I can see the real market at work, that's when I become more comfortable at jumping back in.
Right, right. And I guess, and again, I don't want to be Debbie Downer on this, but, you know, do we even think that some of those things, such as no more subsidies or rent abatement, are even going to ever go away? I mean, those are things that are just continually talked about, even ever increasing.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that the stimulus is probably going to go away at some point or maybe greatly reduced. I think
we hope so.
I think the eviction moratorium will eventually go away, probably. I think rent subsidies is a little bit more debatable, but they probably won't be there in nearly the same volume they have been so far. And I think that the rent abatement from landlords is going to go away, right? So I think that most of it's going to go away. To your point, I think the big question, at least on my mind, is the government's patched up a lot of this recessionary effect with a lot of money. The question is, are they going to take it to the finish line where it's almost like there was never a recession? Or are they going to take it to the 30-yard line, the 50-yard line, or their own 30-yard line, right? In which case, they're not going to take it that far, in which case we have a lot of additional effects that will happen after. The problem for someone like me, because I'm really low risk, is that I do not thrive in a lack of predictability type of environment. Right now, there is a lack of predictability as a result of all this stuff, right? So even if I'm sitting for another year or two watching all this unfold, I just cannot get to the comfort level of going in until this has all been, you know, all this artificial stuff has been removed. And now the picture is clear to me, because right now it's being fogged up by all this other money and all these other policies that have been put in place.
Right. In that picture becoming clear, I mean, does that look like, and I don't know the right term for this, you know, some people call it blood in the streets. I mean, is that when the picture, the fog lifts and you go, okay, man, like there's loads of foreclosures. There is, you know, asset repricing. You know, there is, you know, evictions occurring again. Landlords are being able to kick the people out that can't pay and bring in people that can. I mean, is that what, and again, not that that's what you're hoping for. Obviously, none of us are. That's bad for everybody.
Yes.
But I mean, is that kind of what you have to see when you see, when you say that, are you looking for a reset of sorts?
Well, so actually the better way to put it is I'm waiting to see if anything does reset. And so the only way you can see that is when all this stuff gets removed and then you see the picture. And the picture you have in front of you, is it what you thought, you know, or is everything getting reset? Now, my point about getting to the you know, to let's say getting a touchdown from the government is that they get all the way to the other end zone because they printed so much money and there is no reset because they got there, right? They printed enough money to cover up the entire recession, right? And they did all these other policies that covered up the entire recession. The question is, are they going to cover the entire recession up, in which case there probably won't be too much of a reset because it was almost like there never was a recession. Or the only thing you get halfway there to the 50-yard line where we're going to see a recession because they're going to stop at the 50-yard line and that's going to be the end of the game. And then we're going to watch what happens when we don't get to the finish line, right?
Right. But even if we get to the finish line, let's to use your example, let's say we get to the finish line and they've quote unquote printed our way out of this mess.
Yep.
Then what's our dollar worth?
Well, that's a different story, right? That's a different story. But I guess my focus is more on trying to understand this picture and where they're going to get to on the field, because I need to understand when to go back in. As far as all the printing and stuff goes, that's a different discussion. I mean, ultimately, what that's going to happen to you, it's already happening. It's going to continue to lead to higher asset prices down the line. Now, that being said, just because they're doing all this money printing, it doesn't mean we won't necessarily have an asset price adjustment in the interim, right? If they only get to the 50-yard line and then we have a recession and people lose more jobs, get kicked out of the apartments they're in, can't get new jobs, right? No longer have eviction moratoriums and no longer have rent subsidies, for example. Well, if you own an apartment building, you're going to have higher vacancy. You're going to have lower rents to attract more tenants. You're probably, a lot of people I've talked to a lot of syndicators. Some of them may take evicted tenants. Some of them may not. And now you've got a problem where like the pool of tenants you're willing to consider that's out there is kind of small because a lot of them are going to be previous, you know, evictees, so to speak. So once you have a higher supply of these apartments that are available, theoretically, the price will come down and NOIs go down. And at the same time, if you have an economic recession happening at that time, the stock market might come down, which causes more fear, which then leads to less liquidity, which then leads to higher cap rates, even at low interest rates. So there's a lot that can go on, right? So we're going to have to see.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And obviously most of this is, you know, none of us have that crystal ball. So it is, you know, somewhat speculative. It is mostly speculation, but also interesting just to see the various metrics that we have to watch in order to know what to do. What do you think someone should do right now? And, you know, what's something that, let's say somebody's in the market right now, what can they be doing today to protect themselves?
That's a great, well, it depends on your philosophy, but that's a very good question. If you're the type of person who wants to have every dollar working all the time because that's your comfort level, then you probably should be looking for ways to get as much cash flow and much money working as possible and just looking for opportunities that are the best you can find of this, you know, in the current liquidity. If you're like me and you prefer to just be ultra cautious and like just aren't comfortable deploying at this point, then you've got to take a look at what the government policies are going to be, how they're rolling out, what's going to get approved, and probably equally as importantly, the tax increases and some of the stuff that's been proposed that is not as favorable for real estate going forward. You got to watch that real carefully, see what actually gets passed versus what's been proposed. It could be two very different things. And then try to surmise how that's going to affect things. Does that impact asset values in the short term or not to protect yourself? But there's a lot of sitting back and watching that has to take place here in the next 6 to 12 months, which is what I'm planning on doing if you're in that camp.
Right, right. And again, going back to kind of where we started this conversation, that requires an incredible amount of discipline and patience.
Man, this past cycle, because first of all, if you take a look at this past recovery from 2009 till now, it was actually a record long recovery, right? Part of that was because Trump was actually doing additional stimulus measures even while we weren't into a downturn yet. So he was prolonging it. You have this, and I've been sitting on the sidelines under the guise that we were going to have a downturn because I was looking at the length of historical cycles. And so I've already been frustrated. I go through these phases. It's like frustration, anger, you know, all this other thing. And I'm back to frustration again, like maybe from 2 years ago, because,
oh no.
Yeah, because I got a little frustrated by the Georgia outcome, because with more money printing and with more ease policies in place, or more kicking the can down the road, it's taking me longer to find out what the picture is going to look like. That's what I'm waiting on, right? So, but it is what it is. I can't change that. So I'm definitely frustrated. It does take a lot of patience. It's very annoying. You know, in the end of the day, I just know it's the right thing to do. And frankly, I've already waited this long, so it's not going to be that much longer.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's been your strategy. And so, you know, it's just a little more time on your hands. What are some resources people can like, or what are some resources that you use to kind of make your picture clear? I know that's one of the things you mentioned was that you've kind of got to get a clear picture of what's going on, but what do you use? Like what are some aggregate sources that you use that you say, okay, this helps me kind of keep a pulse on the market?
Yeah. So I read about 2 to 3 hours a day of news and data and stuff. And I know that most people don't have the time, but it's a priority for me because of my full-time focus. And I also just want to stay on top of things for my own, just try to optimize things. So I try to get a mix of what I call mainstream media and non-mainstream information data articles. So I'll look at CNBC for mainstream. I like looking at Drudge Report, not for any political reason, but more just because it's such an easy website to use with the links. And there's so many different links and different topics. So just easy to use. And it's a very mainstream. It's one of the top 10 traffic sites in the US. So it's another good mainstream source. I actually use on my Android phone, there's like some Google headlines that come up just to see more mainstream as well. And they're typically more economically focused. Some stuff that I use that isn't as mainstream is something called calculatedriskblog.com. It actually just, all it does is they take the data, like the jobless claims were out today, right? But the great thing of what they do is that instead of just reading the headline on CNBC, it was X amount of people. They take the data, they've been keeping track of the charts for a long time, and they're somewhat objective about it. They do put a commentary in it that I think is typically a little bit too optimistic. But the bottom line is, if you just look at the charts, it's a great place to find these charts to be objective, to look at just the data, get out of the weeds of the media, look at the data. That's one great place to find data. Another one I like, which is a little bit more negative, and frankly, you really got to ignore 2/3 of what they print on there. It's a lot of conspiracy theory and stuff, in my opinion. But they're ex-Wall Street guys. I think they tell it like it is. They really parse through the data well. It's called ZeroHedge.com. Become more mainstream. I started watching it, reading it back in 2009. I think it launched in like 2007, 2008. And now it's pretty highly trafficked. I find it's a really good source if you want to like, so jobless claims. You look at the headline and it's very high today. Okay. But what you don't realize is that last week it was low, and Illinois, for whatever reason, I think they screwed up their data last week because they came in at a very big positive situation last week that skewed the data. And now they're coming in very negative. It's almost like adjusting for the problem. And now it's looking higher this week, but in reality, it's probably not as bad as it looks, right? So you need to have these guys help you to parse this out and to get into that level of detail, which the mainstream media doesn't talk about at all, right? And you miss a lot of important things. Another one that's really good to look at, if you want to know what's really going on with some data like inflation, for example, and look at some ways it used to be measured and start to get an idea of like getting out of the weeds or the way the media quotes it, but maybe the reality of what's going on, is shadowstats.com. It's really good. So that's another one to keep your eye on if you want to try to just high level what is really going on out there in terms of inflation and some other items as well.
Right. That's fascinating. Yeah, it's always good, I think, to use like you're saying, a series of sources.
Yes.
To try to get, because obviously, you know, some people are selling the news, and like you said, they're but jobless claims. Well, maybe, but do we know what it was last week? And how does this all pile up? So that's really fascinating. Let's jump in here to the final four, if we can, with your perspective. And if someone is, say, a patient, passive investor like yourself, what's one piece of advice you would give to them?
Well, let me give two because of the weird times we're in right now. Number one is, you know, if you're looking at a new asset class right now, just be very careful. Understand where you think we are in the cycle. You know, get your own opinion by asking around and coming up with your own, formulating your own opinion as to whether it's the right time for you to jump in or not, because it's a very unique time right now. That's one thing that nobody could deny, certainly a unique time. The other is I would just tell people to be very careful right now because to your point before, we don't know if asset prices are going to reset or not like they would normally at the end of a cycle. And the only reason why that hasn't happened so far is because of stimulus. If you take all the stimulus away, there's no doubt we would have had a horrific recession and a major correction in asset prices already. In fact, it happened in the stock market very quickly. That just shifted because of stimulus and for no other reason. So be very careful right now, because depending on what happens, you know, with the government intervention in the next 6 to 24 months is frankly going to dictate a lot of how the entire market plays out. And unlike a normal situation from the past where you and I could kind of apply to more free market principles to understand what's going on. It's all about the government right now. And it will continue to be like that probably for the next at least 12 to 24 months. And it's something we have to watch carefully.
Interesting. Interesting. I think you may have already answered this one, but what's one thing you're currently doing to stay on top of your game?
Continue to read, always learn, understand, you know, probabilities of certain things happening, understand the policies that Joe Biden is presenting and how they can impact real estate investors. Don't just go into a deal blindly today. If something's coming up possibly in 6 or 9 months that have a huge impact, even on the way that deal is running, you know, if you're counting on huge depreciation and that changes throughout this year, and that was an important part of your business plan, well, know that that's a risk. But the only way you can know that is to keep on top of all this stuff. So that's a very important. This year is absolutely critical to keep on top of what's going on, all these things we talked about.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Talking about something a little more, maybe a little more positive when it comes to giving back, what's one thing you're doing to make the world a better place?
Yeah, great question. So I have for many, many years, I have, if someone's relatively new or they want to network in general, I have a ton of calls with investors. Even if they're brand new, they just want to understand how passive investing works. I don't charge anybody anything. I have the fortune of having the passive cash flow, so I have a little bit more time. And so one of the ways I give back is to try to help other people understand this landscape, et cetera. I'm not a financial advisor, an investment advisor, or anything like that, but I'm happy to help when I can.
Right. No, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. I mean, hey, you're even taking the time to jump on a podcast with me today. So
yeah,
obviously, that's huge.
My philosophy being on here, I love talking to you. We're having a great conversation, but if this helps people, like all I care about is helping for your listeners, you know, and that hopefully that'll be the case. So
no, and that absolutely shines through. That absolutely shines through. So certainly appreciate that. If our listeners do want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Sure. Yeah. Easiest way to reach me is my email, which is jroll, J-R-O-L-L. At Roll Investments, R-O-L-L, investments with an S.com. So jroll at rollinvestments.com.
Awesome. Jeremy, thanks so much for your time today. Certainly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. Hopefully the next time you'll see me, I'll have a haircut.
It looks great, man. I love it. It looks great. Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.